Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, we're recording on Monday morning. So I saw a political ad on YouTube the other day, and it was unbelievable. It was compelling. It was emotional. It was some of the best messaging I've ever seen. And it was from a candidate from North Dakota, a woman who's running for the United States Senate. And it's entitled Wolves. And as soon as I watched the ad, I suddenly understood why she chose the title Wolves, because immediately I was like, oh, of course, The Wolf of Wall Street, that incredible book and movie that was a cautionary tale about greed, corruption, and of course, what? Excess. And therefore, I wanted to open my show, and you have to see it, and you can go to my Facebook page and you can link to it or just look her up, because Katrina Christensen is the name of the candidate. But you need to look at the ad, and it's not about supporting her per se, but it's about what she is doing with the 2.5 minutes that she has. So I am going to play it for you because I want you to hear it. But more importantly, I think you should also attempt to see it because I think it's just really powerful. Okay, here we go, everyone.
When I was a little girl, a wolf hunted our family farm. It wasn't content to pick off a chicken or the family dog. It wanted the whole farm. My father found work, but the wolves found him. My parents always thought they'd catch a break, but they never did. The wolves came for mom and pop stores. They came for cheap prescription medicine. They came for affordable homes. They came for college loans. Forget inflation. Wages never kept up with corporate greed. So I went to school and scholarship. I became an agricultural engineer, fell in love, found a great job, started a family, had 3 kids, and invented 2 patents for Cargill. And made them a killing. When the wolves came to reorganize the company, they found me too. Their first solution every time, cut jobs. Because to them, we're the problem. It's not their risky behaviors. It's not their bad investments. It's our livelihoods, our healthcare, our mortgages, our working class dreams. I'm Katrina Christensen. I'm running for U.S. Senate because Congress hasn't passed meaningful antitrust, pro-family legislation in almost 100 years. They abandoned family farms. They abandoned American manufacturing. They turned healthcare into a trillion-dollar industry. And they let Amazon and Walmart hunt family businesses to extinction. Wolves. And Congress hasn't culled the pack since Teddy Roosevelt was president. I'm an engineer, and I can tell you, problems like we're facing don't fix themselves. We gotta be tougher and smarter and more stubborn than the forces that are bankrupting the American middle class. My kids have no concept of the poverty I grew up with, the insecurity and shame. And as long as they're under my roof, they won't. And our senator should feel that way about us, should be protective of each of our children, our rights, our health, our land and water, our safety, our national security. Our senators shouldn't be afraid to face the wolves.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Can I repeat that? Unbelievable. And as someone who has run for Congress and someone who has run for governor, I had some really remarkable, compelling ads. I never came close to this. And again, as soon as I saw it, I realized, oh, of course, not only does she use the wolves because she's from North Dakota and the farms, but the idea of the Wolf of Wall Street, greed, corruption, and excess. Anyway, I need to apologize to my first guest because I normally don't take this much time. But I think Professor Timothy Leighton, who's a professor of law at Georgia State, will forgive me. He wrote a piece at theconversation.com. His piece was entitled, Mexico is suing U.S. gun makers for arming its gangs, and a U.S. court could award billions in damages. So let me welcome Professor Leighton to the program, and I'm really just excited that you're here. He teaches regulatory policy, administrative law, and torts. He holds a BA and a JD degree from Yale University. So welcome to the program, Tim. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Arnie.
As soon as I saw sue gun manufacturers, I thought, wait a minute, they can't do that. I thought that that was not allowed. That's always been, we've been told that over and over again, because I remember when Bernie Sanders voted to basically give them this kind of immunity. I still have never forgiven him for that. But explain to me a little bit about the history of gun manufacturers and immunity and how the Mexico government thinks it can sort of thread the needle and get around that. And I think the operative word is that the word is called Mexico and it's not the U.S. And so therefore, this was not, you know, anticipating other countries who ultimately would be impacted by the gun industry. But walk my audience through the concerns of Mexico and this 2005 immunity bill that basically has frustrated so many of us.
Sure. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, there were a small wave of lawsuits against the firearms industry, both firearms violence victims, but also municipalities, Philadelphia, Chicago, Bridgeport, Connecticut, filed lawsuits against firearms manufacturers, arguing that they were responsible for flooding the market with guns that found their way into illegal gun trafficking and ultimately crime. In 2005, Congress passed a law to provide immunity for the firearms industry, and it essentially said that no one can bring a lawsuit against a firearms manufacturer or seller for any kind of injury that arises out of criminal misuse of the weapon by a third party. And the basic idea here was is that Congress didn't want the firearms manufacturers being held responsible for gun crimes, no matter what their connection with them was. However, this is sweeping immunity, but it's not absolute immunity. And the immunity shield that federal government granted to the firearms industry does not cover a manufacturer if they've engaged in some sort of illegal conduct. In the words of the statute, there's no immunity if the firearms manufacturer knowingly violated a federal or state law applicable to the sale or marketing of a firearm, and that violation caused injury to some person. So if the firearms manufacturer is engaged in some sort of violation of a statute, a federal or state statute relating to firearms regulation, they don't get immunity. It just doesn't cover them. Now, this federal immunity bill basically stopped most of these lawsuits and they sort of ground to a halt. There were a few that continued on. Mexico has brought a lawsuit now that is somewhat innovative. Originally, Mexico's theory was that the law only covered lawsuits brought by domestic entities for crimes that were committed in the United States. And then in fact, because Mexico's a foreign entity and Mexico was suing for crimes that occurred in Mexico, the immunity bill didn't cover them. The courts have rejected this theory and actually said the immunity bill covers foreign lawsuits just like they do domestic plaintiffs. And so it doesn't matter that the person bringing the lawsuit is Mexico or the crimes occurred in Mexico. However, Mexico has a second theory, and that's a theory that the courts have given the green light to. And that theory says the following: that the manufacturers are actually engaged in a violation of federal law because they are aiding and abetting illegal sales at the retail level. And the complaint that Mexico brought essentially says that Mexico has alleged that the firearms manufacturers, and we're talking about Smith & Wesson, Colt, Glock, Beretta, Ruger, some of the nation's largest gun makers, engaged in, quote, affirmative and deliberate efforts to create and maintain an illegal market for their weapons in Mexico. And the way they did that is that they basically created a business model that not only relies on, but actually promotes and facilitates illegal sales at retail through straw sales, i.e. retailers who are selling to a person who's not qualified to, selling to a person who's qualified to buy a gun, who's clearly buying it for someone who's not qualified to buy a gun, unlicensed sales, kitchen table dealers, gun shows, online sales that are not covered by background checks, off-book sales disguised as inventory theft. So you have retailers who are saying, well, I had 100 guns stolen when in fact they were sold illegally, but they reported as thefts, or oversupply to border dealers, selling huge numbers of guns to border dealers in small towns that the manufacturers know are then being sold to gun traffickers and taken into Mexico. Tens of thousands of these weapons are ending up in Mexico. And the argument is that the manufacturers are aiding and abetting. And in fact, illegal sales and illegal gun trafficking to Mexico isn't a bug of their business model. It's actually a feature of the business model. It's part of what it is they're doing to design their products, market their products, and distribute their products in ways that they can capitalize on this illegal trade.
I read your piece and there was like a wall I wanted to hit, because you also point out, and I'm just going to read directly from the piece at The Conversation by Tim Leighton. Mexico also points to industry marketing that promises buyers a tactical military experience for civilians. And Mexico alleges that manufacturers distribute their products to dealers whom they know serve as transit points. You just made that point, for illegal gun running through illegal straw sales. Unlicensed sales. But the part that blew my mind is where you talk about how they actually create features that would be attractive to the cartels. Manufacturers intentionally designed their weapons to be attractive to criminal organizations in Mexico by including features as, take notes, everyone, easy conversion to fully automatic fire. Ooh, what a cartel would want. How about this one? Compatibility with high capacity magazines. Oh, absolutely delightful. But the one that blew my absolute mind, Tim, removable serial numbers. Can I repeat that? Removable serial numbers. So I am looking at this, and you're right, it is not a bug, it is a feature. You talk about all these things that you have to be, like, you know, numb not to think that the whole design was to basically make sure that those guns ended up in Mexico. But remind my audience about why they are concerned about what's happening with the cartels, why they're concerned about all this awash of guns coming from the United States. Tell people about the gun laws in Mexico, because I think you need to understand they are no way, shape, or form like we are in the United States. They are wicked, wicked strict. And I think people need to see this because and understand it, because then they will know that the only way these guns are coming, they're coming across the border, and it was, in fact, intentional.
Yeah, well, certainly Mexico's arguing that this is a scheme that the firearms manufacturers are engaged in with the retailers. And Mexico's gun laws are particularly strict. According to what Mexico claims, there's only one legal gun store in Mexico, and there is not a constitutional right in Mexico to own a firearm or to bear a firearm for personal use, whether that's self-defense or otherwise. And so Mexico has tried to restrict firearms and obviously has not done a good job, because huge numbers of firearms are coming in from the United States. That's also true with many Central American countries as well. One thing that I think is really important to point out for your listeners, and that is that these are allegations at this point. The only thing that's happened legally is that the First Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the federal court that sits in Boston, the appellate court, said that if Mexico can prove its theories that the manufacturers are designing their weapons to appeal to illegal users in Mexico, that the manufacturers are distributing in the ways that they know are flooding the market for illegal gun traffickers, and that the manufacturers are engaged in marketing campaigns that are sort of touting the features that would be attractive to this market, then they can go ahead and have a day in court to try and prove those things. Mexico has not provided any evidence so far. They've just made pleadings. That's where we are in the litigation. And so what this has done is it's given the green light for Mexico to go ahead in the trial court and bring evidence to show that these allegations that they're making are actually true. And more importantly, they have to convince a jury, not only that they're true, but that in the mind of the jury, that this kind of activity at the manufacturing level is responsible for street crime that occurs in Mexico. There has to be a close enough connection in the law between misconduct, even if it's true that it occurred, and the ultimate injury, i.e. shootings on the streets of Mexico. And that's called proximate cause in the law. And that's a question for the jury to decide. And there are juries around the United States that have heard similar cases like this that have decided that the connection's just not close enough. And those views are views of jurors that may vary. So a jury in Texas might have one view about that, and a jury in Boston might have another. I think it's significant that this lawsuit's being brought in Boston, because the jury in Boston is much more likely to draw that connection than a jury in Texas or Florida might. I think it's also important to point out that Mexico's theory is no longer a sort of unique theory about foreign governments. This is actually a theory that would work for any plaintiff. And in fact, domestic plaintiffs could make similar arguments that the firearms industry is doing things to actively aid and abet the illegal marketing of weapons at the retail sale. And if they can make those allegations stick and prove them in court, then this really could open up a very large liability exposure for the industry, not just from foreign governments, but from plaintiffs as well in mass shootings.
But you know what this reminds me of? I was saying they've got to prove that this is not just a bug, but a feature. And that's really what the whole point is. And then I'm thinking about, like, flavored cigarettes. Okay. And I'm thinking about the fact is that you think the cigarette companies are marketing to children. And then you begin to look at what they did with the ads that they did. And you had to remove the ads from television. So much of what was done was that it became obvious that the goal wasn't to give it, you know, sell cigarettes to people over the age of 21. The whole goal was to make sure that young kids started like having like an attractive nuisance, that they would start smoking earlier. And we were able to, I think, begin to prove that that was the intent. The intent was you wanted kids to smoke. You can't do this. So what's so interesting is that the gun industry has such an incredible moat around them that somehow we think that so many things that you just described. I mean, again, how do I prove something about guns in Mexico? But if one of the features is an easily removable serial number, I mean, I hate to break it to you. What's that about? Isn't that all about trying to get around something? That's not about being able to track a gun. That's about making sure that the gun becomes invisible. And to market something that way and to make that available doesn't just apply to what happens in Mexico. But frankly, if I find a gun without a serial number here, I want to sue the piss off of them because that was the plan. And I do think what's so interesting is you're absolutely right. What this means for Mexico, if they could approve it, how does that not apply here? Because we are looking at the streets of urban America. We are looking at all these things. And so many of the stories that you are now telling are stories that apply in the United States, not to just what goes across the border to Mexico. It's a brilliant strategy. And I can't understand how it's not provable. I think it, again, knowing the headset of jurors, that does have an influence on how they view things. But why does it work with cigarettes and not work with guns?
So there are a couple of interesting questions there, Arnie. You know, one interesting question is the extent to which this can be really pinned on the firearms industry. The firearms industry says, look, we're making weapons that are perfectly legal in the United States. There are no laws that restrict us from making these weapons, designing them the way that we do. They're semi-automatic weapons. They're entirely legal. There's no ban on semi-automatic weapons at the federal level. These are weapons that are marketed in ways that tout a tactical experience, and there's nothing illegal about that. And we're distributing them to gun stores, and it's not our responsibility what the gun stores do. In order to make these charges stick, Mexico's going to actually have to show that the gun industry intentionally facilitated, they aided and abetting in the violation of law, not merely that they knew about it or they're aware or they didn't care or they didn't take precautions, because essentially the immunity shield protects the industry from simple negligence. Unless the industry is engaged in some sort of concerted effort to break the law, they're immune from lawsuits. And this brings us to the second issue that you raised, which is other products. The biggest difference here between firearms and everything else is the immunity bill. If you go back 25 years, the same time that people were starting to sue firearms manufacturers, they started to sue pharmaceutical companies for opioids. And they used exactly the same theories. They said that the opioid manufacturers designed their products in ways to make them more addictive, that they marketed these in ways that encouraged physicians to prescribe them for all sorts of uses they weren't really suitable for, and that they distributed huge numbers of pills to small towns in places like West Virginia, where they knew they were flooding the market and that this was part of their business model. Those are cases about simple negligence. And fast forward 20 years, the pharma industry, one of the largest and richest industries in the United States, has taken full responsibility for the opioid crisis. It's paid out billions of dollars and it's reformulated its products and it's reined in its marketing campaigns. There's been a revolution in pharma because of this. But those are claims about simple negligence, and those kinds of claims will not fly against the firearms manufacturers because the firearms industry enjoys federal immunity that no other industry enjoys in this respect. And so you have to show not only that they were careless here, like the pharma industry, but they were aiding and abetting in a criminal enterprise.
So let me stop you. Pharma was not doing simple negligence. You go to West Virginia, that ain't simple. They flooded West Virginia with opioids. That's not a simple, that's egregious. That's outrageous. You have to be dead from the head up not to know exactly what you're doing. So what you're doing is, yes, the standard may be lower, okay, in order to prove it for pharma. But what pharma proved should have met an even higher standard because it was just so obvious on its face what they were doing. They were not doing something that was a simple mistake. They were doing something that was highly intentional, incredibly targeted, and they knew the consequences. They knew, all right? So I'm wondering whether Mexico can use the pharma example and say their standard was low, okay? Simple. But you know what? Let's take a look at everything they were able to produce. If the standard was even higher, do you think pharma would have gotten away with it? I don't think so. I think they would have met the higher standard. So if this is true for pharma, and we've seen the incredible consequences, and we've seen what they've actually been able to do, you look at what we're doing, everything from flooding, you know, the gun stores along the border, that clearly there aren't even enough people in that town to buy that number of guns. So obviously they're not selling to them. You know what I mean? And you do all this. And again, I hear what you're saying about pharma, but it was so disgusting and appalling and over the top what they were doing. And it was clearly with knowledge and intent. I mean, they didn't have to prove that, but you could see that I would almost bring in all the evidence with pharma and say, imagine if this was the standard, do you think they would not have checked those boxes? Now let's show you what the standard is and how it applies to what's happening in Mexico and tell me we don't meet that standard as well. And I think in a lot of ways, you want to kind of poison the well. I mean, everyone hates pharma anyway. I mean, it's not that you love guns, but you hate pharma. And you may be more likely touched by the opioid crisis sometimes. Maybe, unfortunately, now everyone's touched by guns. But I do see that there really is potential. And even though the standard is lower, I do think that what you can ultimately be able to do is sort of bring both ships up to the same level and say, this was not a bug. This is a feature. They knew what was going to happen. They knew the result. They know what the laws are in Mexico. And that was the whole rationale for doing this. In a lot of ways, pharma didn't have that same burden. But you know what? They could have met the higher burden. I'm not a practicing lawyer. But Tim, at some point in time, somebody has to begin to realize this is exactly their business model. This is exactly their business model. And you just have to be blind and not willing to hear, not to see it. And I think that may be why they're going to Massachusetts, because I might have been a juror. You know what I mean? Right. And yet I guess I have the question for you, and I only have a few minutes left. And that is that so they haven't proceeded yet. This is what they're arguing. They haven't begun to bring forth all their information. I guess the question is, they went to Massachusetts to argue their case. They didn't go to Texas. I'm wondering why they didn't go to Texas. With all the threats of immigration, all the stories about the cartels, all the awash in guns, what happened in Uvalde, all those things, do you really think that a Texas audience would be so numb to this as well? In so many ways, they're more intimate with the consequences of what is happening by arming the cartels in Mexico than anyone in Massachusetts is. I almost think that the whole landscape around guns is beginning to change.
Well, I'm not so sure. You know, in the wake of mass shootings, there are sort of predictable reactions. States in the coastal north, like Massachusetts and New York and California, after there's a mass shooting, generally restrict firearm sales more than they have before. They make background checks tighter. They do red flag laws. They restrict designs. They say you can't buy high capacity magazines. States in the South and the Southwest, places like Texas, Florida, and Georgia, in after mass shootings, essentially just liberalized the right to carry a firearm. And so it's probably the case that a jury in Boston is more sympathetic to the idea that part of the reason we have a firearms problem in the United States is that the industry has really not taken responsibility for its own role in facilitating illegal markets. And I don't think that story is likely to find a sympathetic an audience in places like Texas or Florida or Georgia, where I live. This is a place where many, many voters are very strong proponents of firearms rights, and they tend to liberalize firearms rights, and they tend to be very skeptical of any attempt to try and blame the industry for firearms violence.
Tim Lighton's incredible piece at The Conversation ends this way. If Mexico does win a trial, its demand for $10 billion in damages could drive several of the nation's largest firearm manufacturers into bankruptcy. Stop smiling, Arnie. Even if the case were to settle for much less, a victory by Mexico would provide a template for a wave of future lawsuits that could change the way the gun industry operates. Similar theories about dangerous product designs, irresponsible marketing, and reckless distribution practices in opioid litigation have transformed the pharmaceutical industry. Civil lawsuits have forced the drug makers to take public responsibility for a nationwide health crisis, overhaul the way they do business, and pay billions of dollars in judgments and settlements. Mexico's lawsuit holds out the prospect that the gun industry could be next. Professor Lighton, a fabulous piece, so enlightening. And again, in light of what just happened with the Kansas City Chiefs, in light of what's happening, every day, the two cops and the EMT that just got killed, we are awash in guns. We feel defenseless to the industry. And yet if Mexico can prevail, it gives me hope. So thank you so much for this.
My pleasure, Arnie.
This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Miracles happen. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the ACLU's Civil Liberties Minute. Miracles Happen is the title of the first book written by disability rights advocate Brooke Ellison, who, when she was 11, was struck by a car and suffered catastrophic injuries. A quadriplegic, paralyzed from the neck down, she depended for the rest of her life on a wheelchair operated by a tongue-touch keypad and a respirator to breathe. With all that, in high school, she starred academically and was awarded a full scholarship to Harvard, where her dormitory suite was outfitted with a hospital bed and a hydraulic lift, and her mother roomed with her to make college possible. Brooke Ellison graduated Harvard, magna cum laude, with a BA in cognitive neuroscience and an honors thesis titled The Element of Hope in Resilient Adolescence. Ms. Ellison then achieved her master's in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School and her doctorate in sociology from Stony Brook, where she became a professor of bioethics and health policy, and a prominent national spokeswoman for people with disabilities and for stem cell research. Ms. Ellison said, "I didn't want people to focus on what I had lost in my life, but rather on what I still had in my life." We celebrate the life and mourn the passing of devoted disability rights advocate Professor Brooke Ellison in early February at the age of 45. This has been a Civil Liberties Minute.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Patriotic millionaires. I actually know one of your patriotic millionaires very well. I've known him since I was a kid. Anyway, and you always are providing us with sort of interesting information about really where our revenues are raised, how they're raised, where they're spent, who gets the tax breaks, who gets the tax cuts. I think there's a sense of outrage from the patriotic millionaires that the idea of your wealth means somehow that you are exempt from any kind of responsibility for the country now and going forward into the future. And so they sent me a newsletter on February 8th. And after reading it, it sort of entitled, I think it's called Breadcrumbs for the Poor and Breadbaskets for Corporations, which obviously hits home with me. I decided I needed to reach out to patriotic millionaires and said, can you send someone with to my station to talk about your newsletter? And they did. Bob Lord is a retired tax lawyer and former congressional candidate. He currently serves as senior advisor for tax policy at the Patriotic Millionaires. He's also an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He has written and spoken extensively on the subjects of tax policy and inequality. His work has appeared in the LA Times, the Arizona Republic, Dallas Morning News, Newsweek, and other print and online publications. He previously served as an adjunct faculty member at Arizona State University School of Law. So let me welcome Mr. Lord to the program. Thank you so much for doing this, Bob.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So let me go back to the title again. It's the idea of breadcrumbs for the poor and breadbaskets for corporations. as I was reading your newsletter, I was familiar with what had happened because I've been sort of following the story for a while. But it's the story of bipartisanship. Now, as soon as I know bipartisanship, what do I know is the Democrats have sold out. That's what bipartisan means in this Congress.
Exactly.
Not
Am I right? Exactly.
As soon as you hear bipartisan, take a shower. Take a shower, everyone. And so
actually, what it means is the rich are getting richer.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, Bob, I'm just going to read from your from the article and then I'm going to toss to you. And this is what is written from about a week ago. Last week, now probably 2 weeks ago, in the kind of rare show of bipartisanship that seems to only occur when it benefits rich Americans or corporations, by a vote of, listen to this vote, 357 to 70. That never happens. That never happens. House Republicans and Democrats voted to pass. Ready? Here's the title. The Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024. And it turns out that this $78 billion package will, among other things, expand the child tax credit and extend a trio of major corporate tax breaks. And it turns out that about 23 Democrats voted against the bill because, as they argue, it gives too little relief to poor families who need it most and entirely too much unmerited relief to ultra profitable tax dodging corporations that don't need it at all. So let me welcome Bob Lord to the program. So, Bob, thank you for doing this. Thank you for working with the Patriotic Millionaires. And I'm so grateful that these rich people are pointing out that they don't need this kind of relief, number one. And number two, let's talk about even the title. Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024. That title is a lie. That title, it's not truth in advertising. It's like a fig leaf. It's like cover for what ultimately most of the money does and goes to. And as you point out, it is breadcrumbs for the poor. But you mentioned that as you were sort of learning more about this bill, that you immediately went to TikTok. So share with my audience what you did on TikTok, which we'll now have to all go and look at. But I think it's important to understand how the game is played, because we're the suckers. And I think it's time that we get informed.
Yes, absolutely. Arnie, my TikTok video, which I'm not sure how to give your folks a link to it, but maybe you can put it on after the show.
Sure.
I started out by saying this should have been called the huge tax breaks for corporations and breadcrumbs for poor children act, because that's what it really does. The price tag they put on it is woefully misleading, for one thing, because the $78 billion, there is $35 or $37 billion or something like that in enhancements to the child tax credit, which is a good program. It does mostly help families in need. Mm-hmm. But the other half is wildly understated. What they do is there's like $170 billion in tax cuts for corporations in the first couple years, in 2024 and 2025. And then supposedly things turn around and the corporations pay more tax in 2026, 27, 2028, and so forth, right? And the net cost is supposedly $37 billion. And that's because these tax breaks for the corporations expire at the end of 2025. But what do you think is going to happen at the end of 2025? Here's what's going to happen. The same thing that happened in 2010 and in 2012. The Republicans will frame the expiration of the tax cuts, of Democrats allowing those tax cuts to expire, as tax increases. And they will say, yes, the Democrats are increasing taxes. And enough Democratic senators either will buy into that or at least be cowed by it so that all those corporate tax cuts are extended. So overall, the cost will be five times as much for corporations. And this little time, really breadcrumbs, you know, we're talking about a couple hundred dollars a year for most families that will benefit from this from this deal. And then here's the other thing that it occurred to me the other day, and nobody, I don't think, has pointed out. These tax cuts for corporations, well, who owns the stock in those corporations? Largely the ultra rich, right? And so the ultra rich.
Oh, but they're going to talk about your 401k. I mean, you know what they always do? They always, and I'm looking, I mean, I wish we could sort of say, so your 401k comes up to about an inch. And then the wealthy, they have about a couple of feet. Okay. So their investment depth is so much greater than yours. And they're telling you, well, you may make another $100 on your 401k as they're making, you know, a couple hundred million on their investments. So again, they always hide behind the spoonful that you have as opposed to, you know, the entire sort of massive amount of mining wealth or whatever they have on the other side. And it's such a false equivalency is what right. I'm trying to say. Go on, Bob.
If you kind of follow it through, the ultra rich are going to get richer from this. And that's not costless. It's not like you give, you know, $1 billion to the poor, to poor children, and $1 billion to the ultra rich. And it's like that $1 billion isn't going to do any harm. So the poor children do okay, because when you put dollars in the pockets of the ultra rich, they do bad things with those dollars. And so it's not costless, right? They'll spend the money on lobbying for some other pernicious bill, or they'll contribute to a right-wing candidate who will win with their financial help. And ultimately, somebody will get hurt by those benefits that are being handed out to rich people who don't need them to pay for more goods and services or anything like that. They're not in need. They're not going to do good things with that money. And so this is like, even if you assume it's like an even Steven thing, you're not taking into account the other side of the equation. But,
and actually,
but
the
it's
rich
way
benefits-
worse than that because of what's going to happen in 2025. Those
okay,
but benefits
before,
are before going
we get,
to get
before
worse.
We get to before we get to 2025, let's stick with your $1 billion here and $1 billion there.
Yeah.
And you know what? The rich get it both ways. Because not only will they don't need the billion, so therefore they will hire the lobbyists. Therefore, they will insure the revolving door. Therefore, I mean, they already have enough yachts, so they're not going to buy a yacht. I mean, they're gonna do mischief, okay? And mischief with the political landscape. And you and I, what that means is, you know, super PACs and dark money and everything else. Let me introduce you to Leonard Leo. Anyway, but if I'm listening to this story, I want to remind you that the billion that's going to the poor, and here's one of the reasons why so many Democrats voted for it. I want to give them at least a little bit of a tiny bouquet. I'll give them one dandelion. And the one dandelion I'm going to give them, which is not a bouquet, is that it actually gives the tax credit to people that don't pay federal taxes. So historically, my understanding is that if you didn't pay federal taxes, that meant you were so dirt poor that you didn't benefit from the child mm-hmm. tax credit. And so now what this does is at least it gives to the people who are so dirt poor. I mean, they pay other taxes. They pay sales taxes. They pay taxes on their cars. They pay a lot of taxes. They just don't even earn enough to pay a federal tax. But at least now they will actually be able to get this tiny little child tax credit. So that's the rationale in the head of all my Democrats that voted for it. But as I'm listening to you, and let's go to 2025 in a second. But the other thing is the rich benefit as well. Now, why from the $1 billion? What do you think those poor people are going to be paying for with their child tax credit? They're going to be paying their gas bill. They're going to be paying their electrical bill. They're going to be paying their rent. They're going to be paying for food. Oh, wait a minute. Who owns the land? Oh, who's the landlord that owns what they're living in? Who owns the utility that they're paying the utility bill with? Who owns the car payment that they're making the car payment to? I mean, think about it. The rich win both ways.
Well, not only that.
Go on.
Not only that, Arnie. Think about the investments that could be made with the billions that are going to the rich. Let's say they invest in one of these private equity funds that buys up housing in a city like Phoenix. So that drives up the prices of Phoenix real estate, drives up the cost for home buyers, and drives up rental prices for tenants. So again, you've got these benefits that are flowing to the ultra rich. They're not harmless. They're harming people. People in Phoenix will be paying higher rent indirectly from that. That never gets taken into account.
So, Bob, why don't we create a cradle to grave, like you follow the tax dollar, you know, like the bouncing ball, you follow it. And then pick a couple of people who are going to get this billion or, you know, some of the money from here and just follow, you know, ultimately how much they have now, how much they have in the future, how much of that. I mean, people don't know how the rich make their money. They don't, because they're not rich. Okay. They don't understand what they do with it and how rich they really are and how insidious the story you are telling is. Money is fungible. Okay. It just absolutely is. And I keep thinking about the incredible grotesque tax cuts that Donald Trump gave to the rich and corporations. I mean, and people are saying, well, look at how much money they spent on political campaigns. No, I said, we spent it, because by giving them the tax cuts, they didn't have to even feel it. And all that extra cash could go into basically buying the political ads in order to ensure that their next Republican would win. I mean, but we're paying for it because they didn't need the tax cuts. They didn't even want the amount that Donald Trump gave them. Corporate America was blown away when they saw what kind of a tax cut they got, because it never.
Oh, it's an investment to them.
Yes. Oh my God.
I mean, first of all, it is an investment. They spend money electing these people, and then they get tax cuts that far, far exceed what they put into the campaign. But not only that, they have so much wealth. I mean, if you think about what you contribute to a campaign compared to your total net worth, your wealth, it's really insignificant. I mean, nobody worth $1 million contributes $100,000 to a campaign. They might contribute $1,000 or $5,000. Well, it's the same for these ultra rich folks. They're worth $1 billion. They might throw a couple million dollars in, but they have so much money that what's really breadcrumbs for them is a huge amount in the context of the campaign. And they make that money back in investment returns within months, maybe even weeks.
I know. It absolutely scares the heck out of me. But I love the quote that's included in the Patriotic Millionaires newsletter. Representative Lloyd Doggett, Texas 37, everyone, my big audience is Houston, put it best in a speech that he delivered on the House floor before casting his opposing vote. Okay, so I'm going to cover Lloyd's butt. And here's what he says. This corporate tax windfall bill, thinly disguised as helping for children, offers even more tax advantages to corporations that are paying today. Now, take these numbers down, everyone, that are paying today a mere 7.8% tax rate. A working mother of two earning the average wage pays a federal effective rate of 20%. Minimal help for children. Maximum benefits for those who are failing to pay their fair share. And again, here's the other problem, Bob, is that, you know, we want civic education. I do. But one of the first things I want to teach is tax policy. That's the last thing. I mean, I'll be walked out of the school if I try to even start by that. I'm going, that's civics. It's called math. You know, you like math. Think of this as STEM for government. Okay. And I want to teach tax policy, because unfortunately people look at rates and they assume that the rate is what they actually pay. And what corporations love is the idea of a rate, because they know that what they're actually paying is called the effective rate. And there are some corporations that are actually not paying a dime, but they're actually getting money back from the government. But yet they're under this umbrella of, well, this is the corporate tax rate. No, it ain't. Because when you actually suddenly realize what they actually have to write in the way of a check, you have to know what the effective rate is. And that's the other problem. It is so complex. It is so obtuse. It is so difficult to understand and follow it, that's the corporation's friend. You know exactly what you're going to get in a child tax credit. You don't need to be sophisticated. You could have like first grade math and understand it. But when you're talking about what happens with corporations, from everything from tax rates to being able to sort of write so much stuff off, I mean, that's the other thing that's in this newsletter, is things like you get to write things off. You know, and the speed in which you get to write things off changes the whole nature of what you owe. Who knows that? Who understands that? Well, they do, but you don't. And explain that too, because again, that's part of the problem. It isn't just the kind of tax cuts you're assuming. It's like these cleverly worded things that they know means they go to the bank right away, and you have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I explained this a little bit in my TikTok video. The biggest piece of these tax benefits to corporations in this bill is where they're taking expenses like for equipment or for research and development, expenses that will generate income, say, for the next 5 or 10 years. And so they deduct those expenses right away. That's what this bill lets them do. Instead of having to write those expenses off over 5 years or over 10 years, they deduct them right away. They get a whopping big tax benefit up front. And then the income will come in over the next 5 or 10 years, and supposedly they will gradually pay tax on that. So there's this mismatching where they get to take the expense ahead of the income. Well, that functionally is just a giant interest-free loan to corporations like Amazon and Chevron. That's what we're doing here.
Well, and the fear is that you're being replaced anyway with the machine, okay? So not only do they get to write it off in the first year, but guess who they're firing? You.
Well, okay? Yeah, because it
go on.
It subsidizes the automation of jobs. Look, if a corporation can pay $100,000 for a machine and save $500,000 of wages, well, that's automation that should happen, right? That's progress. But if a corporation can only save $100,000 of wages by purchasing a machine for $100,000, and so it's a break even, but they do it anyhow because the tax law subsidizes the machine purchased more than the cost of the employees. Well, that's wrong. We shouldn't be using the tax laws to accelerate automation beyond where it would naturally go. And that's to some extent what's happening here.
Well, you know, remember way back when I used to be on a tear about SUVs, okay? I was on a real, and remember at one point we gave small business the ability to write off almost the entire cost of a huge SUV. I mean, it was like, it was unbelievable. It was almost, they were almost encouraging the purchases. Remember that? I remember going, excuse me? They got these SUVs for nothing. We actually wrote into the tax law that they could buy one and write the whole sucker off.
Arnie, like, it's worse. It's worse than that. It's worse than what you're describing. Me, this is what happened.
They
had these provisions in the tax law, and you couldn't get the same benefit for purchasing just like a car, like a sedan, right? You only got the benefit for the huge SUV. So you had like doctors and lawyers in their professional corporations were buying these giant vehicles because it benefited them tax-wise to have the giant vehicle rather than a regular old car. It was crazy.
Did they make this into a documentary? Somebody needs to make this into a movie. I want people to see a doctor climbing out of a Hummer that he can't even get into. But the only reason why he's got this behemoth is because he got it for nothing because of the tax provisions. It's like, no, again, these are the dirty little secrets that nobody understands. And think about it too. Not only did they drive the acquisition of these enormous vehicles that got basically no gas mileage. All right. They were driving the climate crisis. I mean, think about this. Right. Again, all the consequences, the ripple effect is just so incredible and so unconscionable. But the only people who could benefit from that kind of even thinking about that acquisition had to be a very sophisticated and fairly wealthy, company. And that's not you. So you had to spend the $16,000 to buy your little Fit, and they had to spend nothing to buy their whatever it was, their vehicle that was an SUV that ultimately not only did they not need, but it hurt all of us from an environmental perspective. It is so shocking. But the other thing I thought was interesting, because in closing, not only does this newsletter talk about it, but it also talks about the benefits to foreign corporations. Now, how is that possible, Bob? I mean, I keep thinking about tax policy and that it should actually just apply to what's happening here. But it turns out that so much is in this Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act that it's not only homegrown companies, but it's going to also benefit foreign corporations as well.
I don't know about foreign corporations, but it certainly benefits foreign investors.
Oh, that's right.
Institute for Taxation on Taxation and Economic Policy did a study on this, and they found that in the year 2025, the benefits flowing to foreign investors will be greater than the total of all benefits going to American taxpayers, including rich American taxpayers. So more benefits to foreign investors than all American taxpayers combined in 2025. Because foreign investors, do really well when corporate taxes are decreased, because they don't get taxed nearly as highly when the dollars come out, when either their shares are purchased. If a foreign investor sells their stock in an American corporation, there's generally no tax. And if they get a dividend, there is a tax, but it's a lower rate than Americans pay tax on dividends.
Can we put that in the TikTok too? Let's do a TikTok. I want a billboard that says that. You know how we're all like, oh, you know, we want money to stay here. We want to give money to Ukraine. We don't want to do this. You know, it's all the idea of, you know, everything has to stay here. Well, I think they should look at this bill. And what you just told me about foreign investors making more than everyone, the rich, the poor, the child tax credit, making more. I'm like, excuse me? What the heck is this about? And in a lot of ways, you know what? I mean, it plays to the Trump base, because the Trump base has already been massaged to hate anything with the word foreign in front of it. I mean, let's be honest with you, you're right? Okay, well, then I'm going to shove the foreign right back at you, because I want you to know exactly what happened here. This is not benefiting you. You know, this is, and frankly, it would benefit America if they'd given more to the poor than if they'd given the corporate tax cuts, if they'd done that with the rich, because by basically investing in people who are struggling with a child tax credit or whatever you could have done, the money would have stayed here, would have improved your community, would have improved your livelihood, everything. It would have been like fertilizer for what's happening in the economy here. Instead, under this title of a bill that basically is, you know, false advertising, you find out that, you know, it's foreign investors who like cash out. It is so shocking to me, and yet it's a story that never gets told, Bob. It's a story that never gets told. And that's why, I mean, I'm grateful to the patriotic millionaires, but how do we clone this messaging? Because this is messaging for 2024. The problem with this messaging for 2024 is that only 27 Democrats voted against it. And so how do you like give cover to the Democrats that voted for it? And I know what the cover is. It's the people that don't earn enough to pay, you know, to get a child tax credit. But the sellout is so immoral, and we always do it over and over again. I'm sympathetic, but I'm outraged. And that's part of the problem is how do you do this with good conscience? Because you know, in the end, even by helping these poor families, what you're ultimately doing is 2 years from now, cutting them off at the knees. And that's
right. And you know, what's so hard, Arnie, is that tax law is complicated, and making this understandable for people who don't have, you know, 2 hours every evening to read about tax law is really hard.
Well, I'm grateful John Stewart is back on the air, because I'm going to give John Stewart his assignment. Okay. And no, I swear to God. And the other problem is we're also fighting MSNBC.
Because can you get me on there as a guest?
Oh, I'm working on it, Bob. I'm working on it. Absolutely. We're talking with Bob Lord. He's a retired. I want to go on with you, Bob. Bob Lord is a retired tax lawyer and former congressional candidate. He currently serves as a senior advisor for tax policy at the Patriotic Millionaires. He's also an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been talking about the bill that passed with a whopping 357-270, known as the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024. Actually, it's a giveaway to corporate America. And with that, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, Bob.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-